But we saw that in the Middle East, you know, as soon as the Iran war kicked off, they had to evacuate all of their bases. The bases are there for if there's a war, but as soon as a war starts, they have to evacuate them and put them in hotels so they don't get bombed by Iran.
We do really seem to have fucked this one up, like, you think so? Royally. I mean, I think it's like an impressive level of fucking it up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, war with Iran was always going to be a foolish quandary. And I think most presidents were able to resist that lobby.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have, I know this is a very stupid question, but like, what the fuck are we doing there? Like, I have one theory, which is like, well, you know, American national security and stability in the Middle East and whatever. It's like, I kind of think it's just Netanyahu said to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like no other reason, because we're increasing the cost of fuel. We're sabotaging the American economy.
So
I saw
stupid.
An estimate that, and this is from Reason Magazine, so take it with a grain of salt, but like the knock-on effects of economic slowdown and everything else attached to this is going to be in the potentially hundreds of billions of dollars. We've spent $28 billion around that much just in sheer military cost. But like all of the other slowdown of vital materials and whatever is going to cost us over the next few years potentially hundreds of billions of dollars. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think one of the main things that they're thinking is that, like, we need to show the world that they have to fear us. And yeah. We haven't been doing that for a while.
Definitely not happening,
no,
though.
No, I know.
They're lashing out. Like, yeah, we'll buy the oil, no problem.
Yeah, it's a rabid dog, you know? It's
just like the frantic kick of a dying horse.
A little bit.
For American empire right now. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd say. I mean, it just shows, like, we're a little bit out of ideas.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to fight China.
But what you described earlier is like no one forced Clavicular, any other streamer, to kind of go out and do these like extremely antisocial behaviors that would be frowned upon. But we've created overwhelming incentives for someone to do it. And so it then happens.
Yeah, if you don't do it, someone else will.
Right, right. And so, yeah, you want to be the first mover and enrich yourself, because otherwise you're going to be working in Amazon, peeing in a bucket, et cetera. So I think the kind of discomfort for the conventional liberal way of exploring these things is that we tend to task the individual with that level of responsibility, that these incentives exist, but it is your ethical responsibility to say no to it. And now we have these overwhelming incentives in which, you know, eventually someone is going to like, all right, I will rise to the occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is kind of destroyed or like reformulated the way in which we consider ethical behavior in a market society, because you're talking about the broad systemic deprivation of resources rather than one unethical actor. Was it inevitable that Sneeko would arise and Nick Fuentes and all these people who are now tremendously discursively influential? Was it a kind of market inevitability?
I think so, absolutely. Yeah, those slots were opened up, and it's also like a natural form of A/B testing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So someone will come and try to not say the N-word, and then someone will come and try to say the N-word, and which one rises to the top? I mean, you know.
Right, right, yeah. What do you make of, sorry, we're going to run through all of the like insane conspiracy shit, because I enjoy talking about this with you. I was talking with Abby Martin about the Louis Theroux Manosphere doc, and whether those streamers who are like, you know, the most rage bait people imaginable, are they actually anti-Semitic, or did they just become anti-Semitic because that's what got the most clicks?
I think it's profoundly irrelevant. They have no power over any kind of Semitic population. I mean, this is all just what people say in sound bites, and then people debate something that someone said. I think that you have to look at any kind of structure of power to determine whether it's even relevant to call them anti-Semites. Mm. Not to mention, that documentary was a huge disappointment as someone who's studied the Manosphere for
a
long time.
We haven't caught up on this. What are your thoughts on the doc?
Well, first of all, how hard is it to say that Israel committed genocide? I mean, that just capped off.
The Manosphere doc?
Yeah, at the very end.
From the perspective of the streamers or from Louis?
Louis.
Louis, oh, okay.
Right at the end, he just gets posed that question. All he has to say is, I do believe so, or yes, and he just doesn't. He skirts the issue.
Oh yeah, there's the Spanish streamer who's like pressing him on that, and he wouldn't respond for some reason.
I believe he's British, the streamer.
Yeah.
But he doesn't respond.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, the fact that like he spends a good amount of that documentary talking about anti-Semitism and then refuses to answer that question at the end, or refuses to make like any kind of open statement just tells you, I think, everything you need to know about the focus on anti-Semitism.
I'm not an expert on this, but like, didn't he make, was it called Settlers or something like that? A film like 2 years ago?
Yes, he did.
That was a doc about, what was that? Who is that far right woman who's like expanding into the West Bank?
It's yeah,
like
one
crazy,
of the Settlers.
Like Jewish supremacist mm-hmm. lady.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt that he made that. I'm taking this completely on its own value. You know, it's not an accusation of him. I think the main accusation I would levy at that documentary is that it was surface level, uninteresting. The insights provided were kind of your typical, I think, liberal slop, you know, of like, but why are they doing this? You know, they love to ask that question. Mm-hmm. But why did he say that? Great. So now we're going to spend, you know, all of our time interviewing some of the stupidest people, I think, alive, instead of looking at the structure, right? Mm-hmm. I think anti-Semitism is a very interesting one because the way I try to look at things, if they're going to be a societal issue and we're going to have a huge debate about it, then where are the dead, right? Where are the bodies at the end of the line? Mm-hmm. Like, where does this machine where there's words at the top and concepts, you know, like criticizing Israel mm-hmm. or even going mm-hmm. further like Sneeko and being, you know, fully kind of anti-Semitic in his statements, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where does that trickle down as pain or violence onto innocent Jewish people? Mm-hmm. Where? Mm-hmm. I'd love to know that. Because I think like debating anti-Semitism is oftentimes a debate about what words are and aren't allowed. Mm-hmm. But there's no true structure of oppression behind it. And it actually wastes our time discussing power structures that don't yet exist. Like the concept that maybe one day there would be enough anti-Semitism for it to suddenly become a kind of rained down violent act that targets Jewish people. Mm. But until you know, that happens and we're just policing and we're trying to say that anti-Semitism is different than any other type of racism or that it's one of our biggest problems in our society. My question is, where are the bodies? Mm. You know, really, because
I'm pretty sure they're in Gaza right now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure that's where the bodies lie. And so it's, to me, slightly irrelevant. I mean, I don't mind expounding on it, but is it truly, truly relevant? I would say no. I prefer to look at what's really actually physically going on rather than whatever weather vane of discourse has currently been activated by someone blowing hot air into it, you know? Mm.
What then, okay, if this is, I promise I will not publish this on the main episode, like, okay, if this is—
I don't give three shits, you publish whatever the fuck you want.
If this is your analysis, then, you know, what is the kind of hyper-mobilized revolutionary vanguard that, you know, my instinct with this is to stay in the most contested space and try and reach for the lever that is furthest upstream, being the seat of power, the executive branch, from which you could then stack the courts, you can do a dozen other things, and you can pull up the boot from the highest position possible. But I mean, are you like a total Bolshevik, or like what is the program that you see unfolding here?
Listen, I'll be honest. I am not super familiar with a lot of political theory.
I'm not averse to a little Bolshevism myself.
No, and I'm not trying to hide it. Like, I am. I'm definitely like what you would qualify as extreme left. Yes, I believe that the struggle exists, but I question the idea of electoralism and the idea that content will save us or journalism or even history or any of these practices will kind of change the course for this country. Until I see, I mean, we're struggling to even allow somebody past the primaries who believes that we, you know, should have free healthcare. We're struggling on that, let alone somebody who's gonna go up there and say, hey, we have 1,000 military bases. I'm gonna shut down like 75% of them. That would be the beginning of a tiny tangible change that might affect the giant structure of pain and despair and violence that is currently the world order. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I tend to look for things in tangibles. I think that there are countries that are fighting, and they are Iran, they are Venezuela, they are Cuba, they are—
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
They are countries who've gone through a revolution and are willing to say fuck you to the United States. They're willing to say it. Look at Europe. Look at Europe. Absolutely closing their eyes to, if not fully supporting, the genocide in Gaza. Staying real quiet and weird about Iran. You know, even though Donald Trump couldn't go more out of his way to spit in their eye and tell them he doesn't give a shit about NATO.
Did you see this thing that China is not honoring the U.S. embargo on Iranian oil?
Why would you?
This is very significant, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, why would you honor anything? This is a country with no honor.
Well, I mean, we don't keep our promises. We used to be able to police that with our, you know, global military footprint. Yeah. But
well, it turns out that like a bit like a prison population, you know, if everybody starts getting mad at once, there's not enough guards. Okay, that's what we're Iran has shown very clearly that this country is so fucking full of shit in terms of what they can and can't do, and that's because at the end of the day, the real threat the United States has over someone is I will genocide all your people. I will kill them all. Not I will bomb strategic locations. It's I will do what we did to those girls in that school at the beginning of the war with Iran to all of you.
Yeah.
And then the reality is, if that really even starts, if the United States even starts to massacre more and more of the civilian population, what exactly do you think the result is going to be? The rest of the world's going to be scared? No, the rest of the world is going to further arm itself and further collude to do what is right, which is resist this enormous, evil Fourth Reich, this a world order controlled by one central power, centered around big business, crushing unions, and, you know, killing people who dare to rise up and demand, like, better material conditions.
Speaking of structures, you recently launched a new show called Superstructure. Do you want to tell us about this new show? We're up to, I think, episode 2 or 3 at this point. Give us a preview of what's coming up.
Sure. We are about to cover Ted Shackley Jr., who's a bit like the Forrest Gump of the CIA. He ends up...
Forrest Gump of the CIA. Okay.
He ends up involved with like everything under the sun that you, you know, have read about like during a 30-year span of CIA activity. So it's fun to see all of that through the lens of one individual who was, by all accounts, like a penny-pinching, administrative, serial failure.
Are you going to do all of this in an hour, or is it a mini-series?
No, just Ted Shackley, one
impressive.
Hour. Yeah, we're trying to keep our episodes short. The short blurb for it is that it's a show about power, you know, the power of propaganda, the power of political repression, and the power of freedom struggles the world over. So we're trying to give a kind of international view of what actually happened during these periods of times that have been utterly demonized and marginalized, which I think is ahistorical to believe that there's only one answer and that it's going to be a kind of neoliberal capitalism. It's ahistorical. And so I think the show is an attempt to restore history, connect the dots, and also connect to current events so that people can discuss things like ICE with a knowledge of what the history of this is. Like instead of thinking like that we often think about Trump or ICE, that it just popped out of nowhere is some sort of aberration in this great democratic project.
When you say restore history, I'm going to take that to mean a slow teleological development in the Hegelian sense. A few years ago, you went to CPAC. You wrote about this for Jacobin, and you described a, quote, transnational far-right alliance.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but we are observing this weird kind of international nationalism happening right now.
It's very funny how they discussed it during CPAC. CPAC almost killed me. Very depressing experience. And it was right after Trump won, and I have never seen such a crowd of baying fascists applauding gritty footage of bombs falling on people in mountainsides presented by the guy who's the head of counterterrorism.
This is important. They showed footage of literal bombs dropping on.
It was Gorkha.
Yeah.
And now you can see these jihadists in Somalia.
Yeah, yeah.
And I turned to the president, and it was like, you know, even he, the man who is in charge of counterterrorism now, is talking about movies. He's like, we're in a Situation Room. It was exactly like a Bourne story. It's exactly like one of those movies. And I turned to the president, I said, these are jihadis, we know where they are. What should we do? And he said, kill them. And then they showed the footage of them killing these people, and then everyone applauded. an incredible experience. We live in the Fourth Reich. I don't think I say that lightly. I say that with purpose. We chose our side after World War II. We decided to be what Hitler could not accomplish because he got sidelined by uppers.
You recently did an episode about ICE. What are the origins of ICE?
Well, ICE, you know, what we kind of came to the conclusion of is that ICE is pretty straightforward. After 9/11, they needed a more intense, like, enforcement wing for deportations and stuff like that. But the history of deportations and the United States, and I think the knowledge that the United States was once an extremely open country, like, they were letting in almost everybody, then they deported people that they disliked based on usually, like, racist tendencies or the threatening of the labor market with flooding, you know? So what we really examined in that episode of Superstructure is the tension between the need for cheap labor and the fact that some of these people in power have to deal with voting blocs that don't appreciate having their labor market crowded out. So
what we found
what was interesting is that there was a lot of early union opposition to immigration or wanting, like, a harder line on immigration.
Yeah.
But that plays out more as an intra-bourgeois, like, concern between two contradictory needs, which is, like, the vote of these reactionaries versus the need for cheap labor that you can exploit even further because it's quote-unquote illegal.
So what kind of timeline are we talking about here when you say it was relatively more open before? Is that, like, 100 years ago, 50 years ago?
Yeah, late, like, 1800s, early 1900s.
And so when does it start to shut off?
Well, progressively along the course of the 20th century and then in a more kind of final and intense way in the early 21st century.
And so Department of Homeland Security, this is like 2002, like post 9/11?
I'm not sure.
DHS is founded after the with the global war on terror post 9/11. And then ICE is under this umbrella of the DHS. Who did ICE's job before? What were the organizations or institutions that, like, carried out this immigration enforcement?
Well, it was a similar structure. It just had very few people. So it was highly unenforceable because there was a time where the equivalent of the entire DHS was staffed by, like, a few dozen people at most. Because it just wasn't that much of a concern.
A few dozen for the whole country.
Yeah. Yeah, it was tiny. There was a period where it was absolutely tiny. And so it was very funny because it was like, on paper, this is what we're going to do. And in reality, they realized we do not have the means to do that. It's extremely expensive to deport people unless they self-deport. So the focus was on self-deportation for a long while. And that existed in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, I've heard that the current reward or award, I'm not sure how to phrase it, but the amount you get for self-deportation is, like, it depends where you're going, but it's like $2,000.
Sounds good. I should take that up.
That's right.
I've been meaning to leave. It cost me way more to get my green card, so, but...
That's true.
Maybe
that's
I
true.
Can
cost
find
benefit.
A new avenue to reimburse some of my costs.
People have talked in the last few years of abolishing ICE and putting those responsibilities under the jurisdiction of the DOJ. Do you have a preferred solution for this?
I don't have a particularly preferred solution. I think it requires a great amount of reform and oversight, and it's something that we're not seeing. I mean, a lot of what's happening now that is worrying is the fact that it's so profoundly extrajudicial.
Was there a certain time at which, you know, if it starts around 2002, that now ICE has taken on kind of a different function under Trump too? Is there's kind of like a slow curve and then it spikes up in the last few years?
Yeah, anytime you kind of like build up a force of this kind, it's going to be bent to the needs of the ruling class. And so for a long time, you know, those needs were different than they are now. So, you know, anti-terror, for example, is going to be a big one. The drug war is going to be a big one. So a lot of them are imprinted in that way. A lot of these periods of time for ICE or its equivalent. And now, of course, it's turned into a kind of presidential goon squad, which makes it even more dangerous because you realize that once you create something like this, it can be used as a paramilitary coercing force.
Would you support a Department of Cognitive Security?
Can Get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here with that named entity that I have to support or not support. That has no manifesto. Well, tell me, present it to me. Hey, sell me, brother.
Department of Cognitive Security?
Yeah. What does it do? What does your new department do?
I heard it described in such a way where, like, we think social media is predatory now because it's like, you know, it's giving you the peanut butter drip and all this stuff, like little kind of doses of sugar or morphine or whatever. And you're like eating bugs in the pod with your headset on and, you know, this dystopian future. So the level at which these AI agents are now going to be even more empowered to do that, basically the joke, the meme of Department of Cognitive Security is to set up a regulatory infrastructure about what data you can collect about subjects when they interact with these platforms so that you can find, like, let's say that, you know, I have a phobia about, like, strawberries. And then whenever I'm going to take a certain action on social media, they show me an image of a strawberry and it persuades you over time, right? You can manipulate subjects much more easily.
Sounds like, sure, your department doesn't go far enough. I mean, you know, we desperately need to treat these, if we're going to keep these networks, we need to treat them as a public good, like communication, the same way that we don't want...
networks, you mean the AI or you mean social media?
All of these companies, social media, everything that we interact with. Social media now is completely inseparable from AI. Mm. They were the first to, like, integrate it very, very swiftly. Even if they don't use it in a visible way, they are using it behind the scenes to make decisions or to collate information, the hell it is.
Yeah.
I would say, we need to be very realistic about, like, what we're doing here. And this... again, comes to the question of the profit motive. If these companies are born in the profit motive and continue to thrive in the profit motive, they don't care about your mental health. There's no national oversight like the way that China has over, like, the effect of private companies' decisions and the products that they're spreading out, like, being poisoned.
Don't mind if I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
How would you feel about turning social media off at, like, 6 p.m.? And then you have to, like, wait until 8 a.m. for it to open the next day.
Oh, people have been saying the nanny state, but you would really. It's bedtime. It's bedtime, my children.
It's bedtime.
You think you can make Americans do anything? If you tell them not to drink a drink that's bad for them, they'll do it just to spite you.
They will. They really didn't like that.
Individualism.
They didn't want their sodas taken away.
A whole country of individuals.
Yeah.
You're talking about building a movement? I mean, individualism is so deeply entrenched. We have no common project anymore. We're all just, like, individuals, atomized individuals on a career path or something like that, figuring out our life. And to me, that's so profoundly depressing. I'm so, like, I hate the fact that I'm so atomized, and I hate the fact that I'm, like, the prime candidate for all this shit to work on, that I'm easily distracted, you know, that I am gluttonous, you know, that I want pleasure, that I don't know when to say stop, you know? I hate that I'm the perfect victim for this and that I was born without a community. I was born without a country. I was moved around so much by the age of 7 that, like, my nationality is irrelevant. I never even lived in that country.
What about getting into politics?
Seeing firsthand the desperate conditions of countries that are under the boot. Mm. I went to high school in Venezuela and in Brazil. So I was in Caracas when, you know, pre-Chavez, when they were publishing the value of the currency every day in the front page of the newspaper because it was changing so fast. I saw the wretched poverty and I saw the bourgeois and petit bourgeois concern about the arrival of Chavismo. Mm-hmm. I also, thank God, was, I think, educated at a school where my teachers, my history teachers, my English teachers, my humanities teachers, I suppose, they really wanted to tell us about the history of where we were. What happened here that made it this way? What happened in Brazil? What about, all these kind of interventions? And, what does it mean to be embargoed? What does it mean to have sanctions put on your country in tangible reality? And so I'd say it's just my experience. I mean, oftentimes I think people are kind of shocked by, like, how badly read I am in political theory. I think that, like...
But you know so much history. I hear you do it, like, every week about these extraordinarily well-researched episodes.
Sure. I'm not doing that research.
Okay.
You're overestimating me. I'm a dunce. I'm a beautiful dunce. I'm a himbo.
Okay.
No, I'm joking around, you know, but I think that the intellectualizing of a lot of these things is kind of somewhat useless. Like, it's oftentimes... It's like a petty bourgeois or even bourgeois concern. I think that, like, direct organizing in these kinds of countries is what has brought us, like, you know, kind of like people's assemblies and stuff like that, that can actually like change the constitution or determine like a change in local conditions, material conditions.
Did you, you know what I mean? Did you encounter the Bevin's book from a few years ago, If We Burn?
Yeah, I've read that.
Okay, what were your thoughts on his thesis with that book? Because I don't expect everyone to be like a, you know, political philosopher, but I do think that there is a kind of core group of intellectuals that have to kind of program the agenda, decide what the priorities are for the movement.
Maybe so. I don't know if I have a huge opinion on that. Mm. But I do think that the book was like pretty dispiriting. I think it was also, for me, it helped put the kind of nail in the coffin of this idea that if we make enough people aware, change will happen. We will mobilize. Not if you don't have guns. Violence is the answer.